After our little break, I wanted to resume my series of talks springing from the book Basic Buddhist Concepts by Kogen Mizuno. Tonight, I wanted to begin to talk a little bit about the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, of course, is one aspect of the Four Noble Truths, one of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, of course, are suffering exists. There's a cause of suffering, which is craving. There's a cessation of suffering, and the means to the cessation of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So specifically, the Eightfold Path is a program of practice to lead us to the awakening of the Buddha, to nirvana, classically stated nirvana. It has eight, as you might have guessed, eight factors, which are right understanding or view, right thoughts, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And tonight I wanted to take the first two steps, which are right understanding or right view and right thought. And as an aspect of right understanding, talk about what we mean by the word right. And hope that will kind of dovetail into what we could talk about in terms of right understanding. Classically, right understanding means understanding and seeing as true the Four Noble Truths, that suffering exists, that is, that we have suffering that arises in our life, and having the sense, the feeling, maybe there is something outside of our suffering, something beyond our suffering, something that addresses our suffering. And recognizing or seeing as true what the Buddha taught, that there's a truth in this, that there's some quality of correctness about it. But there's also and so in that sense, right understanding is the feeling, the sense, the perception that there's something of value in the Buddha Dharma, and that there's something worth practicing in it, and that thing isn't necessarily discoverable or get-at-able through conventional means, through worldly means. In other words, it's the view that there's something worthwhile to do in a religious practice. Now, the right part, because we're Zen practitioners, we're in the Mahayana school, we're really interested in the non-dualistic understanding of what we're doing. In the Avatamsaka Sutra and echoed in the Diamond Sutra, two important works in the Mahayana canon. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it says, correct view or right view is not having any views at all. And what that is pointing at is the idea of that when we talk about right view, we're not saying right as in as opposed to some other view. Right as in the only correct way to do things. In one sense, you could say what we're talking about in terms of right is a view that will help you to do what you aim to do, a view that will work, or a practice that will work to get where you want to go, if where you want to go is the awakening of the Buddha. And this is important because our view, our understanding, continually changes over time, but was always grounded in that understanding of the need to practice the Four Noble Truths. Our understanding of how we practice the Four Noble Truths refines and changes over time. So we can't really say, I have right view right now. Although, in one sense, we can say, I have a view that works because I'm showing up and I'm continuing to do my practice. So the idea of not having any views, so we ground ourselves in the basic practices of Buddhism. What is the correct way to understand practice? And we can approach that. I personally approach that as a question. What is the correct way to approach practice? And it's a question that's continually evolving. I don't think that I have arrived there yet. And I imagine to myself that I'm not going to arrive at some ultimate understanding of what the correct view is. That is, there's this kind of moving quality to it, the movement of the great scripture, great wisdom, always going on. Not having any views means just being willing to let go of our view. We're willing to hold it lightly. A lot of times, conflict, personal conflict, conflict within myself, conflict with other people, arises because of the clash of views, clash of perspectives. It's not to say, we're not trying to convince ourselves that we're wrong, or view our views as being inadequate. It's how we hold them that is significant. And it makes a big difference how you deal with people. I often admire River Master Hario's ability to deal with a whole range of people and situations, and he in some sense embodies this position of not having any views, of being willing to let go of views. It's not that he doesn't have values or have a sense of how to go forward or can be quite firm. It's that my experience of him is that he's always dealing with the reality of the present moment. He doesn't bring preconceptions to the present moment. He doesn't bring prejudgments to the present moment. And the present moment being whatever or whomever he's dealing with. I'm sure he's not perfect at this. I mean, it's just my perception that he's pretty good at it and that he exemplifies it. Sure that if you asked him, he'd say, well, yeah, I'm not perfect at that. Still, he's good at it and inspires the ability to see the value of not prejudging people or situations or just any other being or condition. So there is a significant place for this idea of not having views in terms of how we train. Another aspect of right view that's related to this idea of not having any views or being willing to let go of views, we might call, and which might fall under the heading of right understanding or right view, is what we might call cultivating a religious mind or cultivating a religious attitude. And that religious attitude is, in a sense, taking the Four Noble Truths to heart and saying, okay, suffering exists, and I want to do something about suffering. The Buddha says suffering is caused by craving, and that points right at me. That points right into my own life, my own personal experience. He is constantly directing our view inward. He's constantly pointing back to ourselves. And that's what I'm talking about a religious view. That is to say, one of the ways that we could go about addressing suffering is to look outward and try to create a world in which suffering doesn't arise. Try to control other people and situations in such a way that they don't create suffering for us. And there is some merit in that you know, we work hard in our society to try to get everybody to get along and to, you know, make good laws that, you know, allow people to function but still protect one another and all that stuff. But from the spiritual perspective or the religious perspective, what we're saying is there's only a limited amount that we can do with that. Everybody has a different idea of how society should be organized, all kinds of different things which make it impossible for us to actually create a situation in which suffering doesn't arise. So the Buddha's saying, well, good news is you don't have to do that. If you really want to find peace of mind and awaken to what's really true, what you really need to do is focus inward on your own particular life, your own particular experience, and look at where craving is going on in your own heart and mind. That doesn't mean you want to be irresponsible or anything like that, but just cultivate that, we can cultivate that attitude of mind. Oh, I'm irritated. What is that? I can choose. Do I look outside for the source of irritation? Or do I look within and say, what is it that's irritating me? How do I train my mind so that I cannot be irritated? I want something that I'm not getting. I can look outside. How do I get that thing? How do I make situations such that I can get that thing? Or what is that that's arising in me? What is that craving, that desire that's arising? How do I train that in my mind? How do I deal with that from an internal perspective? And to cultivate that willingness to look within, that's what I'm talking about cultivating a religious mind. And that even that cultivation of the religious mind, in a way, that's what Reverend Master was talking about in his dedication, about the mind that seeks the way. You know, something has appealed to us about religious practice or religious life. Something is calling to us about it, and from within ourselves, something is attracted to something. Something in us is attracted to the religious life, and we're following that mind that seeks the way. And while we don't want to ever give it up, we don't ever want to let it kind of fall by the wayside, we do have to also bear that lightly in the way that we bear view. So what Reverend Master is saying is quite true. We don't want to let it go, but we do want to also bear that lightly. Because the world that we live in, we need to be find ourselves with flexibility in the world that we live. The world that we live in is highly critical of a religious perspective, highly critical of the idea that we can turn within and look and find the solution to our suffering within ourselves. So it's very useful to have flexibility with our religious mind. We don't need to kind of get up on the soapbox and the pulpit and kind of, you know, beat people over the head with it. But it's also really important that we don't let it slip away, because we can get diverted from it really pretty easily. So this is what we're talking about right understanding. That partly to me, right understanding is the perception that in the world, in my life, suffering exists, difficulty exists, and that there is a spiritual solution to that suffering. And I can find that. And that the path of Buddhism embodies that spiritual solution to the suffering that arises in my mind and heart. Part of right thought, then, again, what we're talking about is thought that works, is thought which promotes that, that idea and doesn't allow ourselves to be diverted from it. We're not talking about, it's right thought kind of conjures ideas of mind control and that sort of thing. That's not what we're talking about. But part of the thing, I'm not talking about making you all think about Buddhism all the time or anything like that. But if you can notice in your mind, how do you think about the world? Do you tend to blame circumstances and other people for difficulty that you find? That would be sort of thought that doesn't really work. It doesn't really support the idea that craving exists in my heart and I can do something about it. Other people are doing completely insane things. Don't get me wrong. They're doing completely maddening things. They're doing wrong things. That's not the issue. The issue from the Buddhist point of view, is what can we actually do about it? And the thing that we can do about it is cultivate responsibility for a situation, take responsibility, turn within, cultivate the path. Thinking which supports that idea then is what we call right thinking. We have to identify our own mind and think and see what it is that what kind of thinking leads us into a place where we don't really want to practice. That's partly what we're talking about right thinking. Classically, right thought is divided into three aspects. Thoughts, the first aspect is thoughts of renunciation. And by renunciation, we're not necessarily talking about thoughts about, I want to be a monk. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about thoughts which promote the idea of letting go, the value of letting go. Thoughts which promote the value of kind of daily practice of meditation, the idea of being still, letting things arise and pass away, seeing their true reality. Renunciation really arises out of seeing the reality of circumstances. We can renounce the world, we can formally become monks, because we understand that the world is completely impermanent. This enables us to do this. We can let go of whatever arises, regardless of whatever form we're in, because everything is impermanent. So part of our meditation practice is a recognition of the reality of impermanence and just becoming in harmony with impermanence. Okay. That's what we're talking about renunciation. Benevolent thoughts are the next aspect. And benevolent thoughts are just thoughts of well-wishing for all beings, the wish for beings to not suffer, for ourselves to not suffer. And when we see ourselves thinking negative thoughts towards being, wishing other people harm, wishing other beings harm, wishing ourselves harm, we can say, oh, that's not thought that works. I'm going to let that go. I'm going to keep from pursuing that line of thinking. Benevolent thoughts help us to find compassion, and they help us to let go of our own suffering. They help us to let go of our own pain and grief. And thoughts of harmlessness. The idea, I wish to create as little harm as possible in my life. This is what we're talking about harmlessness. The Indians call it ahimsa. It's not necessarily practical to consider living a life which is completely, in which we can completely not create harm. We have to eat, and we have to eat living things. I mean, even if we're a vegetarian, we eat lettuce and carrots, and you pull them up and cut off their heads. Studies indicate that plants don't like that. And we accept that harm, because we're trying to do something positive. But it is our wish to create as little harm as possible. That's partly one of the things that we can cultivate. And when we see the impulse again to create harm, or the impulse to think harm, to wish harm on another being, we can say, oh, that's incorrect thought. That's thought that doesn't work in terms of my aspiration to awaken to the truth. And we can take it one step farther and say, what can I do about my life? How can I lead my life in such a way as to create little harm? How can I be careful about, creating harm? You know, being mindful as I'm walking down the street and not stepping on bugs, for instance, something like that. Lately, I keep thinking of this kind of raft of plastic floating around in the Pacific. There's supposed to be this huge amount of plastic out there. And I was reading about a bird who had gotten, reading something about birds and scientists and stuff. It was about this bird who'd gotten kind of all tangled up in some plastic. So try to be careful about how much plastic I use as a step towards harmlessness. And, you know, those six-pack containers that you get your six-pack beer or pop soda in that are plastic, you know. So I always make sure to clip those, because if you throw them into the landfill, unclip them, birds tend to get tangled up in them. And this is a minor matter, but it's part of the thing. How can I create a little bit less harm in my life? What can I do to promote harmlessness in my actions? So, renunciation, letting go, benevolent thoughts, and thoughts of harmlessness. These are the classical examples of right thought. And then again, we have the thought, how can I promote my own enlightenment? How can I promote my own aspiration to find and awaken to the truth? Okay. a little short talk, but any questions about that? Yes?
I have two questions. One is, I think I kind of zoned out when you're talking about thoughts of benevolence. Would you mind just reviewing, you know, tell me that?
Sure. Benevolent thoughts are quite similar to thoughts of harmlessness. Benevolent thoughts are just thoughts of well-wishing for other beings, thoughts of hoping for the success of other beings, hoping for the success of ourselves, the wish that beings will prosper, and that sort of thing. Part of what the Buddha talked about is the idea of generosity and generosity of spirit. We may not, Dogen says, you know, even a blade of grass or a single coin of money can promote the benefit of, can promote the arising of good. And the Buddha, one of the first things is that's taught when you go to a Buddhist teacher in the East is the value of the importance of making offerings and being generous. Not because we're trying to get anything, but because that generous mind is tied to the mind of benevolence, of giving. You know, Men's Benevolence Association, probably something, there's something like that I've heard of, you know, which are charitable organizations. And that idea of benevolence, really, the important thing about it, the spiritually important thing about it, in terms of our personal practice, is that it tends to open our hearts, open ourselves to the possibility of something greater, of a deeper kind of reality. And so that practice of well-wishing, of offering benefit to beings, is really important in terms of practice.
Also, so we have the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and do the precepts connect there, or is that a separate?
Yes. The precepts are embedded in the Eightfold Path. So right thought, what we're talking about in one sense, and right understanding are positive ways of talking about the precepts. And so right, and they will come out more in terms of right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right effort to some extent. The precepts encompass actions of body, speech, and mind. And so one of the ways that the precepts dovetail with thought is, for instance, the precept of not being proud of ourselves or devaluing others. Obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, we can lie on various levels, body, speech, and mind, and right thinking is going to be truthful thinking above all. What is really actually true? And so in that respect, the precepts come to bear there as well. So again, yes, the precepts dovetail with the Eightfold Path. Questions or thoughts? Okay. Well, that's what we have for tonight then. Thank you.